This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
To be quite frank, if I was the Labour administration now, bearing in mind they'd had 20 odd years to prepare for power, they should be ashamed of themselves because they can't manage the finances. They've shown that. They've gone begging, 2 years running, begging money from the government, permission to borrow, 35 million or 33 million or something. No sign that they can do any better next year. And of course, ultimately, the people of Medway are the ones that will suffer.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, Medway Council was accused of using fire and rehire tactics. Plans were finally unveiled to fix one of the county's longest-running transport problems, and we found out why the University of Kent staff have gone on strike. I'm Simon Finney, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who reports on borough and district councils. A bit later on, we welcome a former big hitter of the world of local government. Alan Jarrett was leader or deputy leader of Medway Council for 23 years until 2023, when he retired just as Labour took power from the Conservatives. First up, what's been happening in Medway?
This week, Medway Council was accused of using fire and rehire tactics in relation to a group of swimming and aerobic instructors who were told that they would be made redundant at the end of March. They were told, after a long period of uncertainty stretching back to November last year, at the beginning of March verbally, that they could either take up roles as sports officers, which would mean, as well as fulfilling their roles as swimming instructors, they would also be required as lifeguards, cleaners and aerobics instructors. If they wanted to stay just in the roles that they already had, they would need to take up freelance self-employment at £20 an hour.
So how many people are actually affected by this?
Four swimming teachers and two aerobics instructors have been made redundant, but in total another swimming instructor and four further aerobics instructors have been affected by the changes. They say that the whole process has been conducted shambolically and has caused a lot more stress than was necessary. Another kick in the teeth was that although the staff members were told at the beginning of March that they would be made redundant, they didn't get it officially in writing until the 17th. But the day before, Medway Council was advertising positions as freelance swimming instructors on Facebook. Teachers say the sports officer roles aren't appropriate for them as they each have decades of experience, specialised qualifications, specifically as swimming teachers, giving them skills in teaching babies and toddlers as well as SEND children, in addition to normal children's swimming lessons.
What does Medway Council have to say about this?
So a council spokesperson said, the council's MedPay programme, currently underway for all council staff, aims to provide greater opportunities for career progression and pay consistency to attract and retain a skilled and talented workforce. As part of this, the former term time swimming instructor and part-time and casual aerobics instructors roles no longer exist as the work is included within the pre-existing sports officers roles. All affected staff were offered the opportunity to amend their contract to continue working for us in the role of sports officer and senior sports officers through the consultation process.
Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
So I've taken a brief respite from local authority business to go revisit the University of Kent, which are on strike, where staff are on strike this week, yet again, over threats to their paying conditions.
That's increasingly become common at the University of Kent, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's common across the whole country, and Kent's no exception. When I was a student there, I think there was a strike at least once every year for 4 years, and pretty much every year since.
Yeah, so what are the demands this time round?
When the UCU goes on strike, it's sometimes hard to work out whether it's on a local or national strike, you know, issue, at least to an observer. But this one's a local dispute. Basically, it's about the fact that the university has agreed to rule out compulsory redundancies, but only up until December this year. And even, you know, that's only for academics. The uni's refused to rule out compulsory layoffs for professional services staff like marketing and the library services, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this comes off the back of Uni of Kent being in real trouble and being a bit of a basket case, even by the standard of British higher education. The uni is in an awful lot of debt. Over the past few years, it's run voluntary redundancy schemes, and controversially, last year, they even completely scrapped six courses. Even the president of the Uni of Kent Student Union agrees that, you know, higher education overall is in a proper mess, with institutions, you know, struggling to pay their debts and cover all of their costs. So I won't expect the permanent state mild turmoil at the Uni of Kent to subside anytime soon, and the uni administration didn't really give me any indication that they were interested in the union's demise.
Okay.
So, Simon, what have you been working on this week?
I attended a public meeting last Friday night with our colleague Gabriel Morris of the residents of Galley Hill Road in Swanscombe, where the A226 Lancet happened a couple of years ago. And for people unfamiliar with the story, on April the 10th, 2023, a large section of cliff at Galley Hill Road basically fell away onto an industrial estate below. And 2 years on, and the local people were being updated on the progress or lack of it.
And was there anything to report?
Well, in attendance, there were a couple of local councillors, MPs Jim Dixon and Dr. Lauren Sullivan, both of whom have appeared on the podcast, and Toby Howe from KCC. Toby is a senior and pretty experienced highways officer, and he was really the star of the show that night. There were quite a lot of very hacked off people who had been putting up with a lot of disruption in the area, and he dealt with them in a firm but friendly and but knowledgeable way. And he outlined the history of the Lancet from a highways point of view, but was able to say that there are two options to fix the situation, but these will have to be paid for by way of a government loan. One option would be for a physical solid bridge in the same style as the one that crosses the HS1 line, a little wayway. The other option is an earth embankment which consolidates the chalk cliff.
Surely these options will be quite expensive.
They'll be horrendously expensive, depending who you speak to. I mean, we didn't get an official figure. I did ask for a figure, but Toby refused to answer that question. But I made some inquiries. Some people are saying tens of millions, according to one source, and possibly you could even run into hundreds of millions. But apart from the cost, is who is to blame for this happening in the first place? And that's going to form the basis for litigation. So in order for the schemes to get in motion, the government minister will have to agree to that loan, and then KCC or someone will be in charge overall and would have to recover the cost from those who were deemed to be to blame. And that's a different matter altogether. The politics of this are quite interesting because last year the local Tory MPs were replaced by Jim Dixon and Lauren Sullivan, who both have an interest in getting this moving. And Mr. Dixon will be pressuring the minister, Lillian Greenwood, to stump up the money. And this will be crucial for their own electability, but also with the county elections on the horizon too. So that perhaps will maybe see some movement before then. Otherwise, if the government doesn't cough up, then it will be KCC who will be responsible for it. And in the words of Jim Dixon himself, KCC is virtually bankrupt. So the longer-term politics is that it will become someone's problem when the unitary authorities come into being in Kent. So it's an issue that with a bit of jeopardy attached to it.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Our special guest this week is Alan Jarrett, who led Medway Council for 8 of the 20 years the Tories were in charge of the authority between 2015 and 2023, and had been a councillor since its creation. His stint in the top seat has its highs and lows, and he was involved in the town's response to the COVID pandemic, and when he stood down at the May 2023 elections, saw the Labour opposition take control for the first time. He'd had a storied career in Medway politics. Alan, welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
Thank you very much.
So, as I said, you were leader or deputy leader for Medway Council for almost a quarter of a century. At the end, after all that time, what was it like to step down and retire, and what are you doing now?
Stepping down and retiring was fine because I announced that 18 months or so beforehand, so everyone was prepared for it. It got a few people excited about wanting to shuffle seats, but never mind. So I was well prepared for it. It was quite strange for the first few weeks afterwards, from basically being top dog of a large unitary authority to just being Billy No Mates, frankly, and just get on with your life. But I made a really conscious decision to do that and not to tinker, not to interfere, not to be hang around like a bad smell in the background. Let the new leader of the Conservative group, whoever that was, find his own way, and that was what happened. So that was great in terms of what I do now. Always had a busy life anyway. Got a big family. Got 6 children, 5 sons and 1 daughter. I've got 9 grandchildren so far. I enjoy country sports, shooting and fishing. I'm chairman of the largest shooting club in the country, which takes up an awful lot of time. And I'm as busy now as I ever was. The difference being now I can do pretty well what I want when I want, rather than having to do things that have got to be done whenever.
Are there really key events that really stand out to you in your memory?
Yeah, I suppose a few. I think politically, was when we won our first majority in 2003. I was heavily involved in that. I was deputy leader at the time. We were in a minority administration. I was deputy leader. I had the finance portfolio. We fought a really good campaign and won our first majority. We won increased majorities every election rather after that. So I was very proud of that, but very proud of a lot of things we did. I could spend quite a lot of time listing them probably, but a few highlights, I suppose. My personal workload during the COVID pandemic was something I wouldn't wish on any leader. I was having to make with leading officers daily decisions that, you know, in some cases actually saved people's lives. So it was a really difficult time. But looking back on it, I thought we did really well. And to some extent, we led the way in Kent and in the southeast. And James Williams, bless him, who's passed on now, he was our director of public health, and I worked very closely with him. So we did an awful lot of good stuff. And that is the sort of stuff that local government does that people don't see and don't appreciate and have no concept of the mental challenges and the mental stress of leading a large authority at a time like that. So that's my outstanding memory and something I look back on with pride. But well, I think in terms of really sad, the Queen's passing, of course, when I heard that just before the start of a council meeting, actually, over in St George's Centre, that we all knew she was very ill. And then it came through that she'd passed, and we did some very perfunctory formal business to open the council meeting and adjourned it straight away. And I discussed that with the opposition. We agreed we'd do that. And then going on, I was very honoured to read the proclamation of King Charles III. I did that over at Rochester Castle in the gardens there. So that was very memorable. And that's something that no leader of this council is going to be doing anytime soon, I hope. I'm a great supporter of the monarchy. I think it's a fantastic institution. I think the Queen, the former Queen, was a remarkable person. Charles, very affable, very likeable. I met him. I went to his home, along with about 300 other people, I hasten to add. It wasn't a sit-down dinner with him and Camilla. I think they do a fantastic job. So I won't forget that in a hurry. I should never forget it. A lot of other stuff, a lot of the regeneration stuff we did throughout that period changed Medway completely forever, and very proud of a lot of those things as well. Got some things wrong, of course. You know, they say the person that never made a mistake never did anything, and I think that's probably true. There were one or two things to look back on could have been done a bit better, but overall, yeah, I don't think it was a bad 26 years.
Mm. And on sort of the COVID pandemic, I mean, as you say, it was an experience, particularly in local government, that nobody had ever really been through before. I mean, was there sort of a handbook or any sort of preparation? You said, oh, in this situation, there's a contingency plan or anything. Like, what was that, those first, that initial moments like?
Pretty well nothing, to be honest. It was basically, I suppose it's wrong to say we made it up as we went along. It's not strictly true, but it was a learning exercise, and things changed, quite rapidly, where we had furlough and we had the lockdowns and goodness knows what, and all the time trying to keep businesses going, you know, huge government grants that came down. One of the legacy issues of the outgoing Conservative government was, of course, the $400 billion it had to spend on keeping the country and the economy going throughout the pandemic. So we had to deal with all those issues, you know, the eligibility criteria for grants for businesses. All those things were being learnt on the job, sometimes on a daily basis.
Mm. You mentioned some of the, you know, there's some things that possibly didn't go so well during your time as leader. The Labour administration now is currently working on its attempt to get through a local plan, which was something that during your time you didn't manage to update from the 2003 edition that ran out in 2018. What went wrong there? Why weren't you able to get a new one in place?
Basically, they say divided parties don't win elections. And I warned my colleagues at the time that the machinations that were going on in the party and in the associations, one association in particular, was basically the root cause of most of the problems in the group. And it wasn't the Gillingham Association, it wasn't the Chatham Association, so I'll let you work out who it was. That was very frustrating, because the local plan regulation 19 was good to go. there was a row developed over the future of Chatham Docks, and that led 8 or 9 of my colleagues, almost all from one particular association, rebelling and refusing to support the local plan. And you had the Labour group at that time. Interesting how priorities change when you seats change, isn't it? At that time, were adamant they would not support a local plan that had those proposals for Chatham Docks. So I had the choice of going forward with a local plan to council and have a vote that I was going to lose, or withdraw it, and I withdrew it. Now, interestingly, the current iteration of the local plan is very, very similar to my local plan. And the reasons for that are because the choices were and remain very limited, including Chatham Docks. And so there's a huge irony there, isn't it? Huge irony that the Labour opposition, vehemently against parts of the local plan, are now adopting the same parts of the local plan. And that's politics for you. But the annoying thing was that machinations within the Conservative group, egged on by one association, and one could conjecture whether one MP was involved in it or not. People can take a view on that. A former MP led to Medway being the poorer in terms of being 2 or 3 years behind on local plan process that it should be in. And of course, then the work of our planning officers becomes much more difficult in resisting speculative planning applications in the absence of an up-to-date local plan. So I understand that the current administration, the Labour administration, are bringing forward a local plan that contains many of my proposals. So I told you so.
Does that frustrate you?
It annoyed me enormously at the time. In fact, one of my cabinet colleagues, I sacked because of it, because he changed his decision from one Tuesday to the following Monday with his arm up his back, I suspect, to no longer support the local plan that he voted for on the previous cabinet meeting. So I had to dispense with his services over that. So, yeah, I suppose it was frustrating, but I actually said at the time, if you think you're going to save the Hoo Peninsula from housing, and if you think you're going to do the right thing as regards, we don't want the infrastructure, that £170 million HIF bid, for example, then be careful what you wish for, because you might not have the infrastructure, you might not have the local plan, but you're going to get the housing. And that's exactly what's happening now.
Yeah, you mentioned divided parties don't win elections. Do you see that as a central element that eventually led to Labour winning in?
No, I think it was part of it. It wasn't central, I don't think. I think there were two things that happened. One was Labour did an excellent job in terms of the boundary changes. They basically run rings around our team and got very favourable boundary changes. That was the first thing, so credit to them for that. And of course, the increasing unpopularity of the Conservative government. So what was created really was a perfect storm. And then you got issues about you need to fight. And we had done 6 winning elections on the bounce. We formed a strong, coherent election winning team with common policies, common literature, where we couldn't have any of that at that election because one association thought it knew better how to do everything. So we were divided in terms of delivery of our policy, divided in terms of some of the messaging, and divided parties don't win elections, period.
And, I mean, obviously you had announced you were going to step down at that election well ahead of time. But even so, I mean, what was the feeling when Labour took control of the council, won all those seats?
Well, not great, was it? Not great, obviously. Nobody likes to see that sort of change. Bearing in mind, we come off the back of, you know, a generation of Conservative victories in Medway. Medway Unitary had never had a Labour administration. It's got one now, and look at the mess they're making of it too. So, you know, get what you wish for.
Were you disappointed that because you were stepping down, you wouldn't be in a position to challenge them when they were in charge?
Not really, I don't think, because I think the current leader of the Conservative group, George Perfect, he's doing a really good job. I think he's got a lot of potential as leader, and I talk to him now and then, and maybe you just chew the fat about things. So I think they'll do okay as an opposition, but it's so long ago since I was in opposition. But I remember it being soul destroying at the time, and it must be soul destroying now because you don't have a majority. You can't do the things that you want to improve Medway. You're no doubt looking across the aisle and thinking, well, I don't agree with that. You're making the right haulics of things, but you have to go with the flow. That's politics, I'm afraid.
When Labour took over, a big thing they talked a lot about was the financial situation of Medway Council. And over the past couple of years when they've been setting budgets, they've talked about how difficult it was because of the financial situation that your administration left them in. If I want to put their side to you, why did you leave it in such a bad situation?
Well, I don't think it was in that bad a situation. I think we've heard nationally today, being in power, being in government, is about choices. So some of the choices that they made in terms of managing the budget since they've been in power has revolved around begging money from the government, borrowing, racking up huge debt. There's going to be a £50 million shortfall by the end of this council term. Someone's got to pay for that somehow. They've prevaricated and delayed on lots of projects, Innovation Park, Medway. They've been on record of telling downright lies about it, saying there was no one lined up to take occupancy of it, so nothing's happened, and that's not true, and that can be evidenced. So I think, to be quite frank, if I was the Labour administration now, bearing in mind they'd had 20 odd years to prepare for power, they should be ashamed of themselves. Because they can't manage the finances. They've shown that. They've gone begging, 2 years running, begging money from the government, permission to borrow, 35 million or 33 million or something. No sign that they can do any better next year. And of course, ultimately, the people of Medway are the ones that will suffer. So it's so easy to blame the opposition, isn't it? Blame the other party. Oh, you left a financial mess. But every year when the opposition replied to my budget speech, there was never any sense of understanding the nuances of local government finance, never any sense of having any positive ideas. And what they've done since they come into power is basically the only positive things they've done in Medway are things they inherited from us.
I mean, to be fair, I mean, in your final budget, for example, when you set the budget at the beginning of the financial year, you used £8 million of reserves to balance that budget, which... It's kind of, that's a thing that you've been criticised for by the Labour group, because it's kind of spending money that you can only use once. It's not a sustainable way. So I think from that year, the reserves levels were at 26 million and now they're down at the minimum legal required levels. I mean, do you regret spending that £8 million as part of the budget?
No, because... That budget, you picked one part of the budget out, and that budget was based on very sound thinking at the time. And what you've got is terms of budget sustainability. I suppose you could say that if they accuse me of not having budget sustainability, they've learned a very good lesson, because since they produced two budgets with not a prayer of sustainability, underpinned by 30-odd million pounds worth of borrowing permissions. So I think before they... criticise me and my colleagues in the last administration, have a good look in the mirror and think, am I doing a good job? Did I actually learn anything from 20 years in opposition? And I think the answer to that for me is self-evident. They didn't learn a thing because it's not being demonstrated.
You mentioned the Innovation Park Medway as well. Labour have said up until very recently whether they've significantly changed the plans for Innovation Park Medway, where it's now going to have a care home and things like that. But they called it before this change a white elephant. How would you have made it work? How would have you made it not a white elephant? What firms would you have got in?
Well, we were making it work, bearing in mind all the infrastructure was being put in place and pretty well was in place when I left. We had two major companies on the point of being signed up, one on the southern site, one on the northern site. We had quite a number of other inquiries that I personally turned down because we wanted that site to be to create high GVA jobs. Good quality jobs. I could have filled it up quite easily with companies that wouldn't have had added to the gross value added in Medway at all. In terms of a care home, that says stated ambition. So a couple of questions came to my mind straight away. Firstly, where are they going to get the money from to build it? Well, they're good at borrowing money, so no doubt they'll go to government and borrow money. Who will run it? And almost certainly, being Labour's track record, it will be run by the public sector. And the reason that our administrations outsourced all our care homes is because they were financially unviable under local government terms and conditions. So what I can see there, assuming they can assemble the money, is a massive white elephant of their own. So again, be careful what you wish for. You know, they think it's a jolly good wheeze, a jolly good idea. Let's have an 80-bed care home. Costs of building it, costs of running it, terms and conditions that are so associated with all of that. It's going to be a long time in the making, and it won't make very good reading on the balance sheet, I promise you that.
But I think they might push back and say, you know, Innovation Park Medway had was a project that had been going on for a number of years before they took over, and there were no tenants for it. You say there were two ready to go. I mean, who were those companies, and why didn't they sign on?
Well, I don't think this is the time to say who they were without reference back to those companies. Are you happy for your names to be bandied about on the airways? I don't think that's right.
You can use them and say that they were ready to sign up, but we've only got your word to say that. Obviously, when Labour came along.
No, I've had this discussion through other media, and FOIs have been done, and other media colleagues, Radio Kent, they know who those companies are.
But in terms of, even if we put those two aside, why is there only two? It's a large site. Why would you say you were turning down businesses, but none are on there? What's gone wrong?
Well, I think if you set high aspirations, high goals, so high GVA, high number of jobs, then you should stick to that. And some of the options I had were basically warehousing, employing five people, a forklift and a dog probably, do nothing to improve Medway's offer, do nothing to create those high GVA jobs, do nothing to create the up to 3,000 jobs that we envisage that site to host. So if you look, you know, the strap line, you know, beyond expectations, you have to aim high, and I'm afraid spending tens of million pounds on the infrastructure for the site and then filling it up with a load of low GVA jobs, it wasn't the way forward for us, and that's a matter of choice.
But could you not argue there's nobody using the site at the moment? So you've spent all this money, but nobody's using it.
Nobody's using it because Labour stopped it dead in its tracks, and we would have had two coming on site. And I think they used, you're from Manchester, so I think you would know that the Manchester Old Trafford Stadium mantra was build it and they will come. And that was exactly my thought processes with Innovation Park Medway. Build it and they will come. So once you had the first couple in and sending out that strong message, people would come. And I'm afraid sometimes short-term gain isn't the right way forward. So I could have cluttered it up with all sorts of businesses. And no one would thank me for it.
Looking at the Labour Party, I don't think there's any... It's clear you don't agree with them on many of the things that they've done and that sort of thing. But is there anything that you think that they've done well so far?
Yeah, I think they've done quite a few things well. And as I said, all the things that we left them, that we started. Chatham Waterfront's a big example. We started that. Innovation Park Medway, we started that. They made a horlicks of that, of course.
You've had many run-ins with the current leader, Vince Maple, over the years. He's Labour and Arsenal, and you're Tory and Spurs. But is it true that you went on holiday together?
We ended up in the same place, I admit. It wasn't by design. He was on a cruise liner, actually. It was really amusing because my wife spotted him in the lounge. He's a distinctive character, isn't he?
Yes.
And I didn't see him again until we were, the four of us, my brother and his wife, and me and my wife, we were on one of the decks having a beer, and Vince walked past, and I said to him, "What are you doing here?" And his head almost came off his shoulders. It was really amusing, and we had a good laugh. Yeah. Next time you see him, ask him, did he enjoy the day he spent in his cabin, seasick all day?
I'll make sure to do that. When you reflect back on your sort of long career in politics, what's the biggest thing that you learned throughout everything?
Basically, that most people, members of the public, are good, decent, hardworking people, and should be respected for that, and all have their different perspectives on life. The other thing you learn in politics is that don't trust anybody. Don't trust anyone until you learn to trust them, which is quite a high bar for me. The other thing you learn is that most elected councillors are good, well-meaning people and want the best for their area. So, you know, that's a learning exercise. And I suppose the most important thing and the most important advice to give anyone, if anyone's seeking advice, is it's hard work and you've got to work hard. And not necessarily in Medway, but I've seen it other places where, you know, some elected officers are inclined to be a bit tardy. And we were never that, and would never tolerate that. So
final question is, we're looking now at local government reorganisation and a possible devolution to Kent Mayor and all this sort of thing. And it seems like in all the different versions, Medway Council, as it exists now, will cease to exist in a couple of years' time. I mean, what are your thoughts on this? Does Kent need a mayor? Should this local reorganisation go ahead? Will it be useful?
I think the concept of elected mayor is absolutely abhorrent. I think it's just an elective dictatorship. And it's just another layer of government and hugely wasteful. That's what I think. That's the first thing I think. I led the North Kent cluster. I chaired that for several years, which included, as well as Medway, Swale, Gravesham, Dartford and Maidstone, one of three Kent clusters that we all jointly worked together with. I think that was absolutely the right approach, and it is the right local government reorganisation is the local approach. It is the right approach. I've always classed myself as a unitary snob. I think that is the only financially viable form of local government. And I thought and still think that Kent should be broken up into three unitaries. I know Vince Maple at the moment seems to be favouring three or four, whatever works. The concept is the same, which eradicates the districts and boroughs and does away with the county. Now, I always said in the run-up to the election, the next Labour government will destroy the counties, which a Conservative government would never do because of the power that and influence that the counties have within the Conservative Party. So that is now happening. That's now going to happen. And I think that the two-tier structure of counties and districts is hugely financially wasteful. Take Kent, for example. There are 14 local authorities, there are 14 chief executives, etc., etc., etc. Millions upon millions being needlessly wasted. So I think it's a really positive development. I actually spoke to Vince on a radio phone-in, actually, not long after I left office, and said, you've undertaken to protect Medway's sovereignty as a unitary. Just confirm that's your intention. And he replied, yes. So becoming part of a larger unitary won't necessarily protect that sovereignty in its current form, but it'll be the next best thing, and I think it's the right approach. Providing, of course, that they don't allow somehow Kent County Council to exist in some form as some sort of strategic being somewhere up there in the ether, you know, with a mayor and all the rest of it. We'll end up with a mayor, no doubt, but I think it's a mistake.
So by that, I'm assuming you're not interested in a return to politics as possibly Kent's mayor?
No, I'm not interested in a return to politics, period.
Thank you very much, Alan Jarrett.
The Lower Thames Crossing has finally been given a go-ahead, hurrah, but it will cost £9 billion, and they say it will be built within 7 years. Dan, is this too good to be true?
I think probably. I have to eat a bit of humble pie, though, as I did, in fact, predict on this very podcast quite a few months ago. They would scrap the Lower Thames Crossing altogether, which they have not, which I'm relieved to see. But I now reckon it will, they said it costs £9 billion, done within 7 years. I reckon you can take that to mean it will cost probably about £20 billion and be done 10, if we're really, really lucky, realistically, probably 15. I'm not entirely convinced. And also, they've left the financing a bit kind of ambiguous, so I imagine it'll probably end up being some, very new Labour flashback, private finance initiative type thing. Is quite inevitable at this point, I would expect. I doubt the government are willing to cough up for it themselves, or alternatively, institute any of the reforms, structural reforms, which would be needed to make it cheaper.
Do you think a government could end up being mired in court cases, as these things always seem to?
Yeah, definitely. So the government is, to their credit, reforming the judicial review process as part of their planning reform. Basically, they'll make it easier for courts to dismiss baseless, or what they consider to be baseless environmentally challenges or other challenges to development at the first stage of the judicial review process, which is good. But the problem they face is that funding, the grounds on which most of these challenges to development, stuff like the Lower Thames Crossing and other development in general, the grounds on which those challenges are made are usually environmental grounds, and those environmental challenges are they're backed in law. People can make those challenges, and there's plenty of lawyers who make plenty of money challenging the government's decisions. And also, while the Labour government says it wants basically this bonfire of quangos, which serve as blockers to all of their ambitions, they won't take that logic to its fullest extent and say that, okay, if the government should be able to supersede quangos, it should be able to supersede international law as well. Because one of the main reasons why there's been such proliferation of environmental challenges to government policy in the past sort of 15, 20 years is the Aarhus Convention, a bit of EU legislation which we haven't left, which caps the costs which can be ordered you know, in a lost environmental challenge to a government decision. Essentially, it makes the bar for environmental challenges very, very low. If the government wants to make sure it's really out of the weeds and getting stuff like the Lower Thames Crossing approved, then it needs to go the whole hog and withdraw from international agreements, which make it easier for activists to vexatiously impede what the government wants to do.
The MPs, look, funnily, we mentioned them earlier on. It's Jim Dixon, Dartford, and obviously Dartford Crossing will be 20% lighter, apparently. And at the other end, there's Lawrence Sullivan, who represents Gravesham. Now, as I understand it, they have quite differing points of view on this.
Yeah, it's been a long point of tension between councillors of all parties in both the areas. But basically, the Labour group in Dartford love the idea of the Lower Thames Crossing because in theory it will reduce traffic in Dartford. And the Labour group in Gravesham really don't like the idea of the Lower Thames Crossing as they reckon it will increase traffic in Gravesham. I tried to ask Jim Dixon about this before to little avail, but him and Lawrence Sullivan, you know, do in fact share an office. So I imagine they've talked at great length about the Lower Thames Crossing. But yeah, their voters and their parties in both their constituencies have very different views on this.
Rob, do you reckon it'll come in on budget and on time?
No, I don't know when it'll come in and I don't know how much it'll cost, but I don't think a lot of people really know that. I just know it probably won't be £9 billion and it won't be in 7 years. I think, although there is always a lot of chat around large infrastructure projects about how long they take and how much they cost, and obviously HS2 is a big one that costs so much, and basically a lot of people don't like it, don't want it, and don't see what we've got for all the money we've spent so far. I mean, it will be quite interesting how long, because it has been confirmed it is going to happen, how long it goes on for people talking about how much it costs and all that sort of thing. Because I always try to take a longer view and look at this and think it will be, I mean, Medway, for example, my area, welcomed the news that it was being confirmed. They said it will help to grow the local economy and increase access to Medway. So they think it's a benefit. I think you look at how much did the Dartford Crossing cost, or how much did the Humber Bridge cost, or how much did all these big, you know, how much does the Channel Tunnel cost? I can't tell you off the top of my head, but I know that they have been probably a net benefit to the areas around them. So although it's good headlines to harp on about the costs and the length and all this sort of thing, but I do think generally more big infrastructure projects like this, it wouldn't be suggested if there was no need for this. And so I think it is a net benefit.
Mm. I mean, there is obviously that kind of the argument that it'll create growth and it'll make the movement, especially of freight and commerce, much more easy and take a bit of pressure off the Dartford Crossing. My only fear is that it will cost three times the original amount and probably three times as long as it's meant to. And by the time it is built, it'll be no longer fit for purpose.
Absolutely. I mean, that is always a concern of if you alleviate pressure on the Dartford Crossing, all of a sudden it's less of a pain in the neck to go in your car. So more people decide to do it, and all of a sudden you've got more traffic. Whether that, you know, rings any alarm bells in people in government's head and think, oh, maybe we should be looking at sort of mass public transport or trying to get people off the roads in some other way and alleviate this pressure some other way. I don't know whether that will happen or what. There you go.
Time will tell. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Thanks to Rob and Dan for their contributions. And don't forget to keep your eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. And you can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss Kent TV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.